Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And let's begin today on the Supreme Court. You know that place where there are exactly nine justices and their terms last their whole lives? Well, on Friday, in case you missed it, President Biden announced that he's appointing a commission to study whether those things should change. Now, many of you know that Democrats were outraged that Mitch McConnell, when he controlled the Senate, refused to hold a confirmation process for Merrick Garland when President Obama nominated Garland when Justice Scalia died in 2016, with Obama having almost a year left in office, right? That allowed President Trump, after his election, to name Scalia's replacement. But then McConnell did hold a confirmation process for Amy Coney Barrett when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, with just weeks to go before last year's election. So Democrats feel like at least one Supreme Court seat, and possibly two, were stolen by McConnell's hypocritical double standard, with huge implications for everything, for justice in America in so many ways. Hence, pressure to add justices, limit terms, or otherwise correct the unfairness. But of course, it's hugely controversial. Even Justice Breyer, one of the, quote, liberal votes on the court on most things, has cautioned against things like this recently. And that's not even the main reason that there is also a movement right now with the slogan, Breyer, retire. So what is right? What is fair? What are the political ramifications? And what do justice and injustice really look like here? We'll talk about that and more now with this week's Monday Morning Politics guest, Dr. Jason Johnson, professor in the School of Journalism and Communication at Morgan State University, a political contributor to MSNBC and The Griot, and host of the Slate podcast, A Word with Jason Johnson. The latest episode is about a major victory for black farmers in the COVID relief package, billions of dollars in aid. The farmers call it fairness. Some Republicans call it reparations. Hi, Dr. Johnson. Always good to have you with us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Good to speak to you this morning.
And I'll bite on your podcast to start. First of all, in the spirit of A Word with Jason Johnson, black and farmer are words that most Americans don't think of in the same phrase very much. Who and how many and where are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about all sorts of different parts of the country. You've got, I mean, some states have, you know, upwards of 6,000 individuals who are considered to be black farmers. You've got black farmers who are not just people who have huge swaths of land or dairy. Black farmers actually includes new emerging businesses like wheat and soybeans and things like that. But historically, black farmers have been routinely discriminated against, not just in terms of land being stolen from them by graft and violence. Black farmers have been robbed by the federal government, that they are taxed and have been taxed throughout time, just like every other business, but very seldom receive the government-insured loans, the protections, the irrigation projects, and things like that that other farmers have. So the COVID relief package actually had a huge, billions of dollars, huge sum of money that will hopefully be distributed properly back to these black farmers and bring them back from the brink of distinction, so the brink of extinction. So that's why this is really important. It's interesting because there are Republicans out there who say, oh my gosh, this is terrible, this is reparations. Well, yeah, what's wrong with that? I mean, there should be reparations. If you have a group of people who've been paying into the federal government in taxes for centuries and weren't getting back the resources that they paid into, of course they deserve reparations.
Right. In fact, that was going to be my next question, because the framing of your episode, I was reading that language from the episode page, that the farmers call it fairness, some Republicans call it reparations. That makes it sound like reparations is a dirty word rather than a form of fairness. So what are the politics of that?
Well, the politics of it are that, you know, on the positive end, and I spoke to John Boyd, who's head of the National Black Farmers Association, you know, he talked about the fact that we've got more African-Americans from states with large farming populations on committees of influence than we've ever had. You've got Raphael Warnock, you've got Cory Booker doing farming policy. You have all sorts of people who are involved in the past who weren't before, and that's a good thing. You actually have advocates out there. He specifically, I asked him about Tim Scott. He said Tim Scott doesn't do much. Not surprising.
Black Republican senator from South Carolina.
Yes, yes. But what this would look like is millions of dollars to help insure or help black farmers pay back loans, loans that farmers routinely have to take out that are usually insured by the federal government but consistently get denied to black farmers, which has caused them to lose land, lose property, or have to get into sort of, for lack of a better word, almost sharecropping lend-lease deals with banks that, you know, slowly bleed them dry. So that's what this will look like positively in the future. And what I asked him, I said, look, you've got Vilsack, who's in charge of the Department of Agriculture. He didn't do a great job the last time he was in this position. But John Boyd seems to think that Vilsack will do a little better this time around because the need is so urgent. And he's a great sort of metaphor. I said, well, you know, if this money is distributed properly, what does the state of black farmers in America look like in 2023 or 2024? And he said, look, black farmers are at a place of almost extinction. And he's like, and, you know, if the federal government says, hey, look, the black bear or the bald eagle is almost extinct, the way you see that you've made progress is if in 2 or 3 years there are more bald eagles, if there are more black bears. And he said, so the goal shouldn't be just to save black farmers, but for the number of black farmers to increase. And again, with things like soybeans and in particular marijuana, there's a real chance for growth in black farming and access to land and resources in the future.
Interesting. Before we transition back to the Supreme Court and other things, is it clear enough to you how this discrimination has been able to take place? Like, presumably, many people would think, if you have loans or grants or anything else that are, you know, available to farmers in America, they wouldn't be certainly on paper by race. They would be by size of farm, what you're growing, things
right.
like that. So how did these become discriminatory?
Well, there's several ways. One, you can simply have regional directors who have a tremendous amount of power, and they choose just not to help black farmers. I mean, it's happened. But at a more systematic level, you can, let's say, the federal government says we're going to provide or we'll underwrite loans for farms that have been able to show a profit for the last 20 years. And the black farmers are like, well, we've never been able to show a profit for the last 20 years because we've constantly been discriminated against in getting access to these loans. So we're always in this bad debt ratio. Well, then you get blocked out. And so because of past discrimination, you're made disqualified from current discrimination issues. Or, for example, you might have we'll provide you with the federal government will insure your loan or back up your loan as long as you can show three different banks that will loan you money. Well, if you're an African-American farmer, hell, if you're just a regular African-American working adult, bank discrimination is very common. So if you can't show up with three different banks that could potentially offer you a loan, then maybe the federal government says, you're too much of a risk and we're not going to give you any money. So you end up being trapped at the nexus of several different systems that routinely have discriminated against African-Americans. And even if now it looks like it's race neutral, the result always seems to be a negative consequence for black people. It's sort of like voting rights laws. Well, you know, we're just saying that nobody can vote on Sundays. How is that specifically disparaging to black people? It's like, yeah, but why does that only seem to hurt black turnout?
Yeah.
So that's what we've seen in farming over the decades.
And interesting that you put this in the context of marijuana farming in the contemporary world, because what we are talking about right now in New York State, which just mm-hmm. passed recreational marijuana legalization, is the fact that there's supposed to be an advantage given to people from communities, largely black communities, that were, you know, the biggest victims of the old marijuana laws, to get the licenses to run dispensaries and things like that. And yet in other states that have tried that, it hasn't really happened because there aren't that many people in the black community with the capital to invest in those dispensaries or other businesses. And so they're trying to correct that in New York State with, you know, grants and loan funds and things like that. But it's interesting that you put this in the context of opportunities for illegal marijuana growing and the discrimination based on capital availability in the past.
Oh, Brian, it's I'm glad you mentioned it's even deeper than that. I just wrote a piece for the Griot. I got an exclusive quote from Jay-Z, you know, the rapper Jay-Z, as most people know, he's probably one of the most famous New Yorkers you got. Yeah, heard of him. You know, he's the most famous New Yorker who hasn't run for president yet. And you know, I got a piece from him in the Griot where he was congratulating the state for legalizing marijuana. And I talked to the parent company, which is sort of the larger corporation that has his sort of monogram brand of marijuana. And we have this discussion that, look, the state can say that 40% of the funding from marijuana sales will go into sort of disadvantaged communities. And, you know, 40%, that's it, given how many black people and brown people were thrown into jail for these previous laws, not to mention the fact that if you don't include black and brown people in the supply chain, it's one thing to have famous rappers, you know, be at the head of boards. I'm not saying that's not a good thing, because oftentimes you need to have somebody in the room. But it's one thing to have a brand that is named after Wiz Khalifa or Jay-Z or Snoop Dogg. It's something else entirely to have a black farmer in upstate New York where she has land and she gets loans and she gets protection and she gets access to environmental tax pay cuts and tax cuts and things like that to grow marijuana, because that means that no matter what happens with the business, her land will always have value. It's different if you have a black trucking company that specifically has trucks that have the lights that keep marijuana plants safe as you're moving them across the country. These are the places that African Americans are often locked out of, and that's where your generational wealth can come from. So, yeah, all of these things are connected. And again, if the right pressure is applied, then that is the future of farming for black people in an area where hopefully we'll see some of these resources going.
And listeners, you know, we were going to start mostly on the Supreme Court with just a word about Jason Johnson's podcast on black farmers, but this got so interesting that we've taken it for about 13 minutes so far. So if there happen to be any black farmers listening right now, call up and tell us something about your story, if you feel like it, that might be relevant to this. I know on a New York City radio station, we don't have many farmers of any color listening most of the time, but just in case, what the heck, we invite you to be included this morning, 646-435-7280, and just to make the transition to other Biden stuff, how do you see the black farmers' provision of the COVID relief bill in the larger context of the Biden push for more economic equity and racial justice generally?
I think it's an example that Biden is actually coming through with some of his promises. We also saw last week that the budget he just submitted to the Senate just has a huge swath of money in there for MSIs, minority-serving institutions, and HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. You know, Joe Biden is looking after the constituents and the coalitions that put him into office. Has he appointed all the best people? Are we thrilled about Vilsack for agriculture? Are we thrilled about Merrick Garland? No, we're not. But are we happy about Vinita Gupta and some of the other people that he's put in the Justice Department? Yes, we are. Do we think that, and I will say this, having been, you know, obviously a clear critic of Joe Biden as I was of everybody else, is he as radical as I would like him to be? No. But is he realizing that because of COVID, we have got to throw some money into investing and transforming the country? He does seem to get that. And if you had asked me a year ago, is Joe Biden going to be that forward thinking? I wouldn't have necessarily thought he was. I mean, pushing for infrastructure, which everybody has talked about for years, but pushing for infrastructure at a point where we have been off the roads for a year and some of us may never be coming back is actually a really good idea. Now is the time to actually push for infrastructure. And that's the kind of work that helps people from top to bottom. When you talk about the internet, that's everything from college kids learning about computer engineering right now in the classroom, out of the classroom, and online to shovel-ready jobs. So I think Biden gets it. We'll see if enough members of Congress get it. Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema get it. But he seems to get it right now.
We'll take a break, and then we'll talk about Biden's commission to study changes to the Supreme Court with Dr. Jason Johnson. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue on Monday Morning Politics, this segment with Dr. Jason Johnson, professor in the School of Journalism and Communication at Morgan State University, a political contributor to MSNBC and The Griot, and host of the Slate podcast, A Word with Jason Johnson. We were talking about his latest episode, which is about billions of dollars in aid for black farmers in the COVID relief bill. Now, let's turn to the Biden Commission to study potential changes to the Supreme Court. That's exactly what he campaigned on, I believe. No promise to enlarge the court, but a promise to study the idea. And I see the Biden Commission has 6 months. So who's on it, Jason, and what questions will they actually ask?
So here's the thing I think everybody needs to understand about where Biden was and what the language is behind this commission. After what has happened with our last two justices, and you sort of mentioned this at the beginning, you had Merrick Garland, who Mitch McConnell basically said, I'm not going to do my job. I'm not even going to hold a hearing on Merrick Garland because we're in the same year as an election in 2016. Then they turned right around. They pushed through Amy Coney Barrett. And then in between, you have Brett Kavanaugh, thousands and thousands of pages of documents of his past legal behavior was denied to Democrats on the committee. There was a sham investigation into allegations that he had been a sexual harasser and or abuser and or attempted rapist at times in his past. So it's not just one or two. You've had three different massive miscarriages of norms, to put it simply, let alone justice, for the last several Supreme Court justices. So many people are concerned about not just having a 6-3 conservative court, but also having a court that seems destined to be routinely undermined by whatever the political leanings are of the Republicans in the Senate at the time, heaven forbid they take control again. So that's the context here. Biden has said he's against what we call court packing, which is really just a pejorative way of saying court reform. So he has now put together this committee that's going to say, look, let's study the problems. Can we have a fair and equitable Supreme Court if we have one party that refuses to negotiate in good faith? Can we expand the Supreme Court? Is there some magical thing about having 9 people on the court? No. We can have a larger court. We can have a court of 12 people. We can have a court of 15 people. We could have a court of 30 people on the Supreme Court. Look, if the United States can expand the NBA playoffs, right? If you can expand the NFL season after 40 years, I don't see why you can't make the Supreme Court bigger.
That obviously one is much more weighty than the other, right? I mean, the Supreme Court and the long history, I realize it's not in the Constitution, but the long history of there being 9 justices, it's not like changing a sports playoff schedule.
True. Yeah. And no one wants another game of the Jets. But I would say that, yeah. the concern is that, and this was sort of proposed about 40 or 50 years ago, that a president would basically just try to expand the Supreme Court whenever they got a ruling that wasn't in their favor. And so that's what this commission is going to look at. Can we expand the Supreme Court without just making the same problems? Can we look at what has led us to this point? I will say this, and there's great writing on this in The Nation by Ellie Missel, who's one of my favorite writers. He's also a good friend, talks about the necessity of this. There's been books written about it. I think at a bare minimum, what needs to be evaluated, and I hope the commission at least has a public report on this, is if you have a situation where the head of the Senate, which is what happened with Mitch McConnell in 2016, there should be a constitutional obligation to at least have a vote. That is what I think is at the core of this. The fact that Mitch McConnell refused to even hold a vote on Merrick Garland because he just didn't feel like it is an absolute abdication of his duties as a member of the Senate. We can't have, of the three branches of government, the executive, the legislation, judicial, you can't have the judicial basically a stool with only two legs because one other part of the government doesn't want to do their job. If we had a situation where there was a vacancy on the Supreme Court, it went down to 8 instead of 9 because someone died, and the President of the United States just said, yeah, I don't feel like picking a replacement, that would be a problem as well. You know, you can't just leave the Supreme Court at 8-8 because you don't feel like looking for somebody on LinkedIn. Right. And that is essentially what we have now with the Senate. So I hope that issue alone, or amongst others, is looked at by Biden's commission.
Let's take a phone call on this. Charles in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Charles. And I will say, Kate in Salisbury Center, New York, hang on. She says she's married to a black farmer. We will get to you, Kate. But Charles in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Thank you, Brian. I live in a building with a Supreme Court justice that just retired from the appellate court that's in New York on 25th Street in Madison. And I just feel that when Clarence Thomas, and I'm African-American, he should have never been confirmed. They did it because it was a kangaroo court. Bush didn't get his first pick. He played golf, and Clarence was confirmed. He should have never said in front of Al Gore and Bush because of the Chad. Because actually, Baker ran the thing from Florida back to Washington, and he knew that the judge in Florida was going along with Al Gore.
Well, wait, I don't want to spend too much time relitigating the Bush versus Gore Supreme Court case. What does it have to do, Charles, with, I think your point is not going to be about increasing the size of the court, but term limits, right?
I think so. I think they really need to look into these justices and put a time on them, because they could just lose it as an individual, or some things can come up and you can't do anything about it, and then it confirmed it's a dead deal. Anyway, thanks for your time, and I thank you for having your guest. He's really quite unique.
Charles, thank you very much, and keep calling us. So, Dr. Johnson, that's another thing in this study commission's portfolio, looking at term limits for Supreme Court justices, not just enlarging the court, right?
I completely agree. In fact, if I could wave a magic wand, I would make three reforms. Number one, I would expand the court from 9 to 12 based on the appellate courts. We have, I think, 12 appellate courts now. We used to only have 9, so it's an easy way to expand it by 3. Number two, I would put in term limits of anywhere from 20 to 25 years. Just do a study on the average amount of time that somebody actually spends on the bench. Use that as an average. And number three, I would make it a constitutional amendment that if there is an opening on the court, that the Senate is required to have a vote within 90 days. And if the Senate cannot find or cannot approve a presidential appointee within 8 months of that position being open, the president is allowed to just put somebody on the court who will stay there for a year. And then they'll have to go through the process again. We can't have a system that's just absolutely dysfunctional because of party recalcitrance.
The caller was talking about a retired New York State judge, of course, a judge at any level of any court is allowed to retire at any time. A Supreme Court justice has a lifetime appointment, but doesn't have to stay until she or he dies. Are you aware of the Breyer retire movement?
I am. And I mean, it's fine and it's cute, but here's the issue. You know, forcing people into retirement isn't going to solve the problem. One of the things that you know, the John Birch Society and the right-wingers were very good when it came to Bush and when it came to Trump, is they would pick not just right-wing justices, but they picked young people. Like, I swear, if Trump could have gotten away with it, he would have picked a judge who was like a third year in law school, right, just to make sure that the person was going to be on the court for the next 65 to 75 years. Fine, Breyer will retire. On average, most presidents get at least two. If you serve two terms, you probably get one or two justices that you get to confirm anyway. But that doesn't solve the problem. Putting in a younger guy or a younger woman for Breyer isn't going to solve the overall problem that the court is rigged in favor of one party if they decide that they want to operate in bad faith like the Republicans have under Mitch McConnell.
And for people who may be confused by this, why would progressives be calling for a relatively progressive justice to retire? It's because currently, obviously, a Democrat is in office and could replace him with somebody who's younger who would be on the court for a long time, rather than take the risk that left some progressives, frankly, angry at Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And you don't usually hear about progressive being angry at Ruth Bader, but for not having retired while Obama was in office. And then we see what happened under Trump. And that was a conversation when she was getting old, she was getting sick, and people were calling for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to retire while Obama was still president.
This is the thing, and I whether it's Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Breyer now, or I'll even take it to Joe Biden and people saying, oh, will Joe Biden run again? Will he hand it off to Harris? Have you ever met any powerful, influential political person who voluntarily steps down? Never. You're never going to. People spend their whole lives. There's only 9 spots available on the Supreme Court, and you can keep the job for life. Almost no one is going to step down from that position voluntarily unless they are physically incapable of doing so. And I swear by all that's holy, a lot of Supreme Court justices would be perfectly happy in a Weekend at Bernie situation where you just carry their corpse in there just so they can keep their names on the mantle. No one is going to voluntarily retire. So your options are to either morbidly wait for people to pass, which is kind of insane, or change the system so that we are not expecting people's human rights to depend on whether or not somebody is going to live. That is a very dysfunctional way for our government to operate, where we're basically waiting out the clock to see if people have a right to marry who they want to marry, vote where they want to vote, or live where they want to live.
And hearkening back to our previous conversation with Dr. Jason Johnson earlier this hour, Kate in Salisbury Center, New York, you're on WNYC. And Kate, I thought I knew the state pretty well, but I actually do not know where Salisbury Center is. Would you enlighten me?
It's right at the edge of the Adirondack Park. And if you're familiar with Little Falls, New York, then we're about probably 10 miles from there.
Gotcha. Hi.
Yeah.
Cool.
And?
Yeah, so I'm white, but I'm married to a black farmer. He's Afro-Caribbean, and I'm from a Mennonite background. So we both have kind of agricultural pasts. And one of the things that really resonated, Dr. Johnson, in what you were saying was about black farmers looking into growing marijuana. Because for us, right, when we started, well, we found out that starting a farm is one of the hardest things you can do. And we had to try multiple product lines before we could actually figure out the one that worked for us. And I have to say that was probably 2 or 3 years of, I don't want to call it wasted effort because we learned, but it was very expensive and it was very intensive, right? And what we finally found out is that specialty product lines seem to do the best from a profit margin perspective. So we settled on raising peonies, if you're familiar with that flower. We sell out every year and, you know, they work for our land. And one of the things that I've been consistently thinking about, and I'm so glad you did this segment, is if there are existing farmers who kind of want to retool or black farmers who want to get into farming, how can we connect them to some of these sort of less well-known specialty crops that I think have huge kind of markets associated with them? And oftentimes don't require as much capital as you would need to get into something like commodity crops or even livestock, which we tried for a while. So I don't know. I think it's more of a question than a statement, but I feel like that's where a lot of the profit is, and I'd really like to see more black farmers getting into that.
That
is she testing the limits of your agricultural knowledge, Dr. Johnson?
No, this is actually right up my alley, and it's an awesome question and an awesome challenge. No, I'm really happy about this because this is what the new bill, this is what the COVID relief black farmers money is supposed to be able to help people to do. It's supposed to be able to help people transition out of less profitable, lower profit farming into new and dynamic areas. And so, for example, look, in the 1970s, when you had maybe white farmers in Georgia saying, I'm looking at where things might be going. I might want to move out of tobacco and I might want to move into sorghum or something else like that. Mm-hmm. They got loans to make those kinds of changes in the 70s and the 80s, and black farmers were denied that. And so you're exactly right. The opportunity to make these switches is where this money comes in, and black farmers weren't allowed and won't given the government support to innovate. I would suggest reaching out to John Boyd, the National Black Farmers Association of America. That's who I interviewed. They are really good at connecting black farmers with the resources from the Small Business Association and this new sort of COVID relief money to make these changes happen. But no, you're exactly right. It's that kind of It's that sort of innovation. It's that ability to be quick and nimble that will allow black farmers to succeed. And it's opportunities they've been denied in the past, but will hopefully be available now or more available heading forward.
Kate, thank you so much for your call. You've enlightened a lot of downstate listeners about a few things. Please call us again.
Thanks so much.
And we'll take one more on this topic. Maria in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. I know where that is. Maria, you're on WNYC with Dr. Jaysa Johnson. Hi.
Good morning. You better know where that is.
You better.
Good morning. I'm listening, and it's the first time, Dr. Johnson, that I hear you speak. I know of your name, and I'm just so happy that I tune in just in time. My question is about the is it a question? Is it a statement first? We have in Sunset Park been introduced to a wonderful and growing group of farmers, mostly from Mexico. People of color who have the great traditions of farming that many people in at least in New York through the farmers markets have come to know. And I was thinking, like in so many other ways where Latinos or indigenous people and African Americans have come together to support each other and move forward. What do you think about all of these wonderful things that are so on point that you have expressed about the what this our government needs to do and must do to for black farmers, that they include black farmers being first because they are the ones that have been the most neglected and abused, that there is some kind of confluence of those two groups to move up together or move out of the situation.
Right. Also Latino, also indigenous.
Yeah.
Dr. Johnson.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's incredibly important. And here's some advice that I got from John Boy from the National Black Farmers Association. He said, look, you know, we have all sorts of people screaming about how we spend money in the military. We have people screaming about all sorts of other budgetary issues. You've got, you know, Mayor Pete, now Secretary of Transportation Pete, so people are tweeting about transportation all the time and infrastructure. If we want those sorts of changes to happen, we have to start paying attention to agriculture. You have to start saying, look, there are Latino farmers as well going through these experiences. You have to start saying there are Latino farmers, there are Asian American, there are AAPI farmers going through these experiences as well. Everybody has to yell and jump up and down and scream and make sure Vilsack knows that he can't just float through this job like he did before. And this is, I want to make this really, really clear to everybody out there who's not a farmer, right? For the people who, you know, hey, maybe you have your garden in Brooklyn or something in your backyard where you make peppers or mint or something else like that. The reason that this ends up mattering is not just because it makes you feel good when you live in a city, but it's about the cost of our food. If we are denying black farmers, Latino farmers, AAPI farmers, the opportunity to innovate and grow and make healthier, more efficient, and wider arrays of food, then that means everything gets eaten up by four or five large agribusiness companies. That means that your peppers are more expensive, your oranges are more expensive. It also means that if there's ever any sort of massive crop difficulties, if there's some sort of issue where there's a huge drought and it knocks out ConAgra, this or something else like that, then we all end up suffering. This country benefits from having thousands of farmers independently who can provide us food because it's a national security issue and it's a cost issue. So that's why everybody should be having access to these kinds of issues, loans, innovations, and everything else like that, because farming is the lifeblood of food and life in this country.
Maria, thank you so much for your call. We'll start our new Manhattan-based Agriculture in the News weekly segment here. Before we run out of time, Dr. Johnson, let me touch briefly on another couple of topics before you go. I'm really curious to get your take on Amazon. The warehouse workers in Bessemer, Georgia, mostly black, I gather, rejected the unionization in a 2-1 vote that was announced on Friday. Amazon campaigned against it hard, as some of our listeners know. Some say they campaign dirty. The core message in either case being the union is just trying to get you to pay dues. We already pay a $15 minimum wage plus health insurance in a state that only requires $7.25 an hour. I'm curious how you see this outcome in labor power, nationally terms, or in racial equity terms, or anything else. Because, you know, conservatives say, don't disrespect the workers' intelligence here by suggesting that they were too stupid to understand their own situations, or Amazon's corporate communications versus the unions went, you know, over their head. What was your response? What would your response to any of that be?
I'm not surprised. Look, you know, we forget, and I, look, I'm a Gen Xer, and some of these workers are Gen Xers, maybe young boomers or something else like that. We forget how radical and how much fighting went into creating and sustaining unions in America. It's not easy. And most people are convinced that if they go it alone, or if they fight, or if they do their jobs well, then that's all that they need. No one ever, unions are like insurance. No one likes paying insurance until your house burns down. Then you're happy that you have it, right? Unions operate the same way. So it's not surprising to me that in a right-to-work state like Georgia, with an employer that pays you much more than the average job does in Georgia, that people are like, eh, I don't see any reason to have a union. Now, I promise you this, you know, in 3 years' time, if Amazon decides to cut back on healthcare, if Amazon decides that they're going to, I don't know, expand the work week to 9 days a week or something ridiculous, whatever kinds of things that Amazon can get away with, those same workers may look back on this decision and say, oh, crap, we don't have anyone to speak for us collectively. You know, unions keep you from having to picket. Unions keep you from having to negotiate on your own if you don't necessarily have a position of strength. Unions keep you from being discriminated against. If everybody down there gets replaced by people on special travel visas coming in from Mexico or coming in from Sri Lanka. So I'm not surprised at the decision. I don't think it's because people are dumb. I think it's because most Americans, as a tradition, do not realize the value that unions brought to the table, that the idea that being paid $15 an hour, it ain't something that corporate America came up with out of the kindness of their hearts. It's because of unions pushing and forcing a minimum wage upon so many countries throughout this country.
And finally, before you go, I want to acknowledge the death of DMX, whose death was announced after Friday's show, so we didn't get to mention it last week. And I see you retweeted Chris Rock on this, and I'll read that tweet because Chris Rock, and he wrote, so sad, such an amazing person and artist. Last time I saw him, we just talked about our kids all day. If anyone out there has a friend or family member that suffers from addiction, don't judge, just show them love and support. Childhood trauma is real. So would you like to talk about your own take on what made DMX important to the world, or a great artist, or whatever your take is?
Yeah. Not only Chris's tweet, but also one of my favorite people, Leslie Jones, did a great tweet with clips from SNL to one of DMX's songs, What They Really Want. I can tell you that there are precious few people, precious few musicians who completely changed how you appreciated music, right? And I can tell you as a kid that when a DMX song came on, when a DMX song comes on today, it is the thing that makes every, it's, he made the kind of music that made you start dancing with a bartender. And there's not a lot of people who can do that. DMX made the kind of music that, you know, the restaurant staff, everybody dancing, you couldn't help but tap your feet and move. But also, he had a style. He had a sadness. The musicians we love are the ones who take, it's just like the comedians. It's just like George Carlin. It's just like Chris Rock. The comedians and musicians we love are the ones who take their pain and pour it into their music unapologetically. He is a man that I think a lot of us have said, we hope he finds the peace now in transition that he couldn't find in life. And Chris Rock is exactly right. He dealt with abuse. He dealt with violence. He dealt with being in foster homes. He dealt with drug abuse. This is a man who was in a lot of pain and poured that pain into music that absolutely transforms our life. And it's sad and disappointing.
And we'll go out with an iconic DMX track, Rough Riders, from 1998, number 79 on VH1's list of the top 100 hip-hop songs of all time. And we thank Jason Johnson from Morgan State, The Griot, MSNBC, and host of the Slate podcast, A Word with Jason Johnson. The latest episode is about black farmers. Jason, thanks as always.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.